From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, October the 15th, 2019. And today we're going to observe Indigenous Peoples Day, which actually was on the calendar for yesterday, but there's an event happening up at the University of Vermont this morning, and we're going to be talking with one of the people most involved in that, a Professor Sherwood Smith, who is director for the Center for Cultural Pluralism at the University of Vermont. We'll be talking with Professor Smith in just a couple of moments after I tell you a little bit about what's coming on later in the show. In the second half hour of the program this morning, we're going to be hearing from one of our CBS News correspondents about the latest on the impeachment inquiry, perhaps a bit of news about what's going on over in Syria, and opening the phone lines to get some listeners in on the conversation about how do we think things are going on the national and international scene. And then in the later hour of the program, that 10 to 11 block, we're going to be talking to a couple people about accessory dwelling units. We've heard a lot about the problem of a shortage of affordable housing in Vermont. One possible solution in some instances could be to build that tiny house in your backyard, or that little extra cottage somewhere on your property, or perhaps just a wing added to the main house on your property, welcoming in perhaps a relative or perhaps somebody you're not related to, anybody. But people are starting to look into more into accessory dwelling units. AARP is actually hosting a talk on this, and the guest speaker, a gentleman, Eli Sepak from Portland, Oregon, who's been very involved in this accessory dwelling unit effort out there, is the guest speaker. He's going to be talking to us this morning in the second hour of the program. And we wanted to get the local perspective, too. So we're bringing in Ward Joyce, who is a design build, an architect based in Montpelier. And Ward is very active in that community and other parts of Vermont. And he'll be able to give us a little local perspective on how about zoning? How about just the general neighborhood acceptance of such things in Vermont? And we'll be talking with both of these gentlemen in the second hour. But first, I wanted to bring in, I believe we have on the phone with us this morning, Professor Sherwood Smith. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining me. And I want you first to just fill our listeners in on what's happening up at the University of Vermont this morning related to Indigenous Peoples Day.
Happy to. I also want to point out that I'm one of the supporters, but I was not one of the primary organizers. That credit belongs to Professor Lacey Sloan and Tiffany Spencer out of the College of Education.
I see. Okay. Well, thanks for that clarification. Appreciate it.
So we're starting out at 10 o'clock, and there's a acknowledgement ceremony happening on the college, Andrew Harris Commons, in the Davis Amphitheater. There's going to be a drumming celebration from 11 to 1, and storytellers, 1 to 2:30 is an Abenaki history and peoples workshop.
Mm-hmm.
1 to 2 is a tour of Native American collections of art and artifacts at the Fleming Museum of Art on campus. 2 to 3:30 is a creative art workshop. 3 to 4:30 is Abenaki spirituality and a religion panel. And 5 to 6 is a film, Nebe. It's a film about the Abenaki people. And then 5:30 to 7 is Working with Indigenous Peoples workshop. It's a workshop to help social service providers and other professionals be more culturally aware and sensitive in working with Indigenous people, and specifically the Abenaki.
Yeah,
our Howe Library has an ongoing exhibit of a collection of books and other artifacts and historical documents related to Indigenous people and the Abenaki.
I see. And Vermont has a difficult history in terms of its treatment of Abenaki, the native folks who European settlers found already here when they arrived. Talk to us a little bit about that and how that connects up with kind of the overall socioeconomic shape and cultural footprint these days in early 21st century of the Abenaki people in Vermont.
I would say Indigenous people in Vermont suffered the same problems throughout the U.S. in which they were displaced from their land, often their rights to property, fishing rights, hunting rights were restricted. Indigenous people were not granted citizenship in the U.S. until 1924. So in Vermont, you had similar history in which the people lost their land. Often ways of life were encroached upon, increasingly limited. And one of the more tragic events here was the eugenics movement, which really targeted the Abenaki and in some ways forced them to go underground and pretend to not be Abenaki to avoid the dangers of forced sterilization. And that was a major event in terms of Vermont's history, especially.
Are there estimates for how much that eugenics movement actually, I would think that one possible upshot, if it was quote-unquote successful, is that it would actually reduce the population of Abenaki, correct?
Well, yes. I mean, both men and women were forced, if they were seen as socially deviant or at social risk for criminality, they were placed in homes, and the only way they could get out was to be sterilized.
Hmm.
And in some cases, young women were sterilized without even telling them as part of other medical procedures.
Yeah, just a shameful history, frankly, and one in which the University of Vermont itself was involved. Is that right?
Yes. One of the recent changes, the library was named the Bailey Howe Library, and the university changed that to the Howe Library as a result of discovering that Bailey played a significant role in supporting the Vermont eugenics movement. And this is true. Eugenics was seen by higher ed across the country, the Ivy Leagues, many prominent universities taught classes and supported the movement for a long time. It was the advent of World War II and the discovery that the Nazis were actually modeling much of what they were doing based on the eugenics process in the U.S. that really quelled it in large part.
Yeah. It really is rather disturbing when you think that basically this movement in the United States was stopped only when we saw this other group, the Nazis in Germany, sort of take it to its logical conclusion or whatever. I mean, is that a fair analysis or am I off the rail somewhere here?
No, I mean, I think that there was a deification of science, the illusion that social problems could be changed by basically controlled breeding of citizens, that somehow poverty, criminality were not influenced by systemic inequality, but rather were a genetic process that took a long time for people to really interrogate and think about in a more complex way. And I think our horror at what started to happen in Europe galvanized people to really see the problems. And, you know, having Nazi Germany actually recruiting eugenicists, sadly, was part of what forced it to the greater attention of the public.
I didn't realize that. Did some American eugenicists go to Nazi Germany and work there?
Not work. At least to my knowledge, nobody went there and worked, but many of them were, for lack of a better word, honored for the work that they were doing and recognized by the Germans as, I don't know any other way of putting it, helping to formulate their own ideas and process for their solution to creating a superior race.
Yeah.
Vermont had fairs where they had the fitter baby contests in terms of people, much like you do, the cows and the sheep and everything, presenting their children in terms of what people thought made them better because of their parentage.
The blue ribbon child at the county fair or something, maybe. I don't know. But yikes, that's that is not a very happy picture at all. I mean, it's not the way human beings want to be treated, certainly.
I would recommend if people want to. There's an excellent book called Breeding Better Vermonters, which is a study of the eugenics movement in Vermont, and I'd really recommend that to people if they wanted to learn more about it. Plus, there's a lot of information out on, you know, YouTube and Google Scholar as well.
Right, right. In the observations today at University of Vermont, I was hearing a lot of programming directed at the Abenaki. It makes sense because the Abenaki, after all, were the native people who were here in this territory we now call Vermont, and so obviously a big connection there, and you would expect that to be reflected. Is there much discussion happening today related to Native populations elsewhere in North America, for instance?
Well, the events actually started last Thursday. There was a presentation by Sarah Adams Cornell at the university over the noon hour. Mm-hmm. Sarah Adams Cornell is a Choctaw, a member of the Choctaw people from Oklahoma, and was brought out to talk about the role of Indigenous Peoples Day on a national level. And so that presentation was sort of the kickoff to this, sponsored by the Center for Cultural Pluralism. And the larger series of events are now happening this week following the holiday yesterday.
Yeah, I'm wondering, do you know how many states now have actually done this transition? Is Vermont the only one so far, or are there a couple of others, right?
Depending on how you want to count it, there are six states, Florida, Vermont, Maine, New Mexico, Alaska. South Dakota celebrates Native American Day, and Hawaii celebrates Discoverer's Day. So all of those states no longer celebrate Columbus Day, and there's about 130-odd cities that also celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah. Now, you sent me yesterday a fascinating article, which I read through last night. It was quite long. I didn't actually read every word, but I got a really pretty good sense of it, I think. And it talked about this discussion that we hear from time to time where Italian Americans are feel like they'd like to see Columbus Day preserved in some fashion or another, and perhaps this change not be made. I mean, that's some of the folks, and then others are obviously differ with that. And but the article really went into some. It was really unpacking a lot of stuff about Italian Americans and actually Italians themselves and the history of that peninsula in southern Europe, where the southern Italians who made up the bulk of the Italian immigrants to the United States early in the 20th century, late in the 19th century, were not necessarily reflected very well by the northern Italians, which of course would have included Columbus. He was from Genoa. And tell us a little about that. Unpack this for us and talk to us about what you know about the Italian story and how that interweaves with the story of Columbus Day and Indigenous Peoples Day.
I'll try. I mean, I'm not a scholar of Italian American or Italian history, but I'll give you my understanding that, as you said accurately, the vast majority of Italian Americans who came in the latter part of the 1800s to the U.S. were from southern Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Columbus was from northern Italy, from Genoa, and was actually serving the Spanish crown, not Italy, in
yes.
his role coming to try to find a passage to the Indies. The northern Italians basically viewed southern Italians as barbarians beneath them, worthy to be servants. There is a continued sort of dismissal of southern Italians as less than, and this in some ways carried over into U.S. attitudes towards southern Italians when they came here. So certainly Italian Americans faced active discrimination in the second wave. The early Italian Americans who came before that were northern Italians and often wealthy and higher class. But so there is a history of discrimination that really wasn't acknowledged. But my understanding is that the challenge is that you're not addressing the celebration of Columbus. One attempts to represent this individual in ways that are historically inaccurate.
Yeah.
It doesn't really address the U.S.'s history of discrimination or marginalization of Italian Americans in any functional way. It doesn't represent the diversity within the Italian-American community, or the historical fact that at the time Columbus came, Italy wasn't a unified country. And in some ways, it plays into this myth that somehow there was no, at worst, genocide, and minimally an utter disrespect and disregard for the history of the indigenous people here. And how do we have that conversation? It's not a simple answer. I think there needs to be a real willingness to sit down and have an honest conversation about what is the history of Columbus, what is the history of Italian Americans in this country, And why would a group of people so attached to this holiday, when the person being represented really doesn't reflect any of the historical inequities that have been played upon Italian Americans here?
Really, it was frankly an eye-opening article to me. I had never really thought through some of these issues the way they were spelled out here, even to the point of some of the bigotry by Northern Italians against Southern Italians stemmed from the fact that the Southern Italians were darker complected. No.
There's a really sad case back in the U.S. in 1919, Alabama versus Rollins, in which a black man was accused of marrying a white woman, and this is anti-miscegenation laws were in place, which said black people and whites couldn't intermarry.
Right.
The Supreme Court of Alabama threw out the case, saying there was no clear evidence the woman being Sicilian was white.
Wow. You are in the education school, is that right, sir?
I used to be a full-time professor in education. I'm now primarily an administrator in the Vice President's Office for Human Resources, Diversity, and Multicultural Affairs.
I see. Okay. And you also are chief of the Center for, I don't have it in front of me.
Director for the Center for Cultural Pluralism. Yes, thank you.
Cultural Pluralism at the University of Vermont. And how would you say, from your perspective, these discussions about the changing holiday from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, well received at UVM? Any pushback, or what's the general sense up there?
I think it's been very well received. About 4 years ago, a group of students actually organized a very nicely done recognition of Indigenous Peoples Day that was really student-led and had a panel presentation. Most recently, our former president, Tom Sullivan, issued a letter formally apologizing for the university's role in the eugenics movement.
Mm-hmm.
For a number of years, our Fleming Museum has had a number of exhibits talking about the role of eugenics, also honoring Indigenous people. So I think the overall attitude here has been very positive and one that really focuses on helping people learn and explore different aspects of this, whether it's artistic, historical, social, and better understand the history of Indigenous people both here and throughout the world.
I promised Jim I'd get him on the air here. Jim from Chelsea, good morning.
To say what another great show you've got, Professor Smith, it's a very fascinating conversation. I tuned in a couple of minutes late when you were talking about the meetings and the schedules and stuff. Could you go over that again?
All right, I'll try to do this quickly. It's out at 10 o'clock with an opening acknowledgement ceremony out on the Andrew Harris Commons and Davis Amphitheater. 11 to 1 is a celebration with drumming circles and storytellers out on the Commons. 1 to 2 is a presentation in John Dewey Lounge on Abenaki history and People's Workshop. 1 to 2 also is a tour of the Native American collections of art and artifacts at our Fleming Museum. 2 to 3:30 is a creative arts workshop at the Interfaith Center. 3 to 4:30 is an Abenaki spirituality and religious panel.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be happening in Old Mill. 5 to 6 is a special film called Nebi, a film about Abenaki people with a discussion in Waterman 413. 5:30 to 7 is a working with Indigenous peoples workshop to help social service providers and helping professionals better understand the history and culture. And the library has an ongoing display that's open on their collection of books and other materials.
Okay, now that's today?
Library.
Yes, that's today, correct?
That's all today.
Yeah.
Okay, how could I contact you if I can't make it today?
You could my phone number here is, the main line is area code 802-656-8833.
Uh-huh.
But I also said at the beginning, I'm just one of the contributors to this larger series of events. I'm not the primary organizer, but...
Okay, well, I'd like to get more involved and learn more about you guys.
That's and I would gather you have a good presence online, too. Is that right, Professor Smith?
We have a nice website.
Yep.
If you just go to the UVM website and look for Center for Cultural Pluralism.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot.
There we go. Thanks for the call, Jim. Professor, I wonder also, you know, with the Abenaki being a minority group within Vermont, my sense has been that UVM has struggled over the years in, you know, at times off and on and so on in its efforts to recruit members of minority groups to campus and make them feel welcome and that they are, you know, an important and integral part of the community at the school. And how would you say UVM stacks up today in terms of its ability to reach out to the Abenaki who remain in Vermont and might want to be educated there?
We have a specific program that works with the Abenaki in Swanton. It's called Summer Happenings. It's a high school program that brings youth to campus for a day on campus to better learn about opportunities and work at higher ed that's been happening every summer for the last, oh gosh, maybe 18, 19 years.
Okay, right.
I think that you're accurate that we don't have a large number of Abenaki students here. I think partially some of that is the distance. I think some of it is cost. I would think that ideally it would be a state issue and there would be an opportunity for those students to have access to all of the state schools, not just UVM. I think UVM has
it is a challenge,
but I think there's always more that could be done.
Professor, I hate to say it, but we are about out of time on this segment on the Dave Graham Show. I really appreciate you taking some time with us this morning to talk to us about these issues. It's an important development, and thank you very much. We will be back with more of the Dave Graham Show very shortly, folks.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back, and you know, we always try to keep an eye on national news on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Many of our guests are bringing in Vermont issues and Vermont topics and so on and so forth, but you got to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, and one of the things we try to do on the show is to present perspectives that are both are Vermont-focused and as well as what's going on in the larger world out there in our country and in its dealings with the rest of the world. And Congress is returning from recess, and the president is, according to Politico, which is an online publication, tends to be, I would say, politically right down the middle, if not occasionally maybe leaning a little bit conservative. But they are reporting today that Congress returns Tuesday to an impeachment inquiry moving into high gear in a rapidly unfolding foreign policy disaster in Syria that's undermining President Donald Trump's standing in his own party. And the president has been taking a lot of heat from his fellow Republicans on Capitol Hill over the last week or so related to developments in Syria, where he suddenly announced last week that the United States would be pulling its troops out of northern Syria. And that has left a green light in a lot of folks' estimation to Turkey to invade northern Syria and try to do serious damage to the Kurdish populations there. Meanwhile, the Kurds had been a key ally of the United States in trying to keep the ISIS group in check. And with the alliance is effectively broken with the Kurds now, there is a lot of concern that ISIS could be resurgent. The Kurds, just a couple days ago, announced they were striking a deal with the Syrian government of Assad in order to try to maintain some semblance of security for themselves, since the United States wasn't going to be there any longer standing up for them. And just as one example of the nightmare that seems to have suddenly sprung open in that part of the world. I saw a story this morning about a young Syrian politician, a 35-year-old woman who, I believe she is Muslim, but she's spoken out a lot about tolerance for the Christian populations there, which have always been in some degree under some degree of pressure and sometimes outright oppression. And she has talked about a multi-ethnic environment there and tolerance for various groups and so on and so forth. Well, she was apparently pulled out of her car and executed by people acting allegedly in behalf of Turkey. And just to think about this woman who is trying to defend the rights of Christians in that part of the world being yanked out of her car and killed, you have to really wonder, where do we go now? I mean, what is the what is the proper reading of this situation? Certainly, much of the president's support in this country has come from evangelical Christians, some of whom worry about the oppression of Christians around the world. And here's a woman working in Syria defending the Christian population there. She's summarily executed. And so I'd be curious to know if folks out there have followed issues of violence against Christians internationally and so on, and want to check in with us and let us know what they're feeling about the situation over there. I'd be happy to take a phone call. I mean, I can't say I'd be happy, because this is a very, frankly, tragic situation that's unfolding over there, but you'd be welcome to call us on WDEV FM and AM, local number 244-1777. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. In a few minutes, we're going to be welcoming Leonard Steinhorn to our air. He is a reporter for CBS News. You'll occasionally hear his voice at the tops and bottoms of the hours here on WDEV when he's contributing a report to their news package that they put together for us on an hour and a half hour. And Leonard Steinhorn, of course, is a veteran of the political coverage in Washington. He is following the impeachment inquiry in Congress quite closely. There are many, many things unfolding related to that, and I'm going to ask Mr. Steinhorn if he thinks that there is any sense that the president's efforts to kind of fight off impeachment and look for support from it, from the Republicans in Congress, might be weakening at all, given their upset over his decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria. I guess I think that was probably not well handled. I mean, is the best analysis I can give it. I'm not an expert on foreign or military affairs, but it seems as though if you are sitting on top of a powder keg or you're sitting in the middle of a minefield, maybe the minefield is a better metaphor here, in the Middle East, you do have troops in northern Syria who are really a key to maintaining a balance of power and a balance of forces that keep Turkey from invading northern Syria, that keep ISIS from being resurgent, that sort of keep the peace in east of the Euphrates there in the northeastern part of Syria. And if the idea is you want to reduce the U.S. role overseas, that's talked about by people on the right and the left. You know, I mean, you hear about it from President Trump. You hear about it from presidential candidates like Tulsi Gabbard, that we need to reduce our military presence in various places around the world. And as an overall goal, that sounds entirely legitimate. But then when you actually go to pull something like this off, to actually draw down troops, you end up in a situation where you've got to be very, very careful. You've got to be very, very smart and, frankly, wise about the way you are doing this. I would imagine if you're talking about a troop drawdown, you're going to be talking to the folks there about some kind of an agreement. You're going to negotiate some kind of deal where the United States gets some promises or guarantees that certain behaviors will and won't happen when the troops are withdrawn. That didn't appear to be the case here. Let's go to Travin in Maple Corner. What's on your mind, Travin?
Good. Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to share with you and your listeners that we're going to have a volunteer American volunteer who went and fought alongside the Kurds against ISIS. On the show today, Michael Alexander, he was a gunner, a Vermonter, who has now returned, and he'll be on the air at 1:05 today on the station.
Oh, okay. Travin, you have the slot Tuesday afternoons here, and you are going to be having, what's the name of this person you're having on?
Michael Alexander. Mm-hmm. He's an American volunteer who spent quite a while in that northeast part of Syria as part of a Kurdish militia, as an American volunteer there as a gunner, and
yep.
back in Vermont, and he'd like to share some of his understanding and feelings about this betrayal.
Well, that's good to know. Folks ought to tune in. It sounds like Appointment Radio, and get a good perspective from a Vermonter who's been on the ground over there. We had a sort of a big picture perspective yesterday from Peter Galbraith, who of course has also spent quite a bit of time in that part of the world, and he is a former U.S. diplomat and was a business person engaged in Kurdistan, really not sort of non-official territory. The Kurds are I understand them described as the largest ethnic group in the world without a state. And so, Travin, congratulations on that get. That sounds like an interesting interview, and we'll be tuning in to check it out and put another layer of thought and insight onto this whole situation over there. So thanks for checking in with us.
Yeah, if people haven't read Peter Galbraith's piece in VT Digger a few days ago, that's well worth it as well. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the call. Hey, 244-1777 is a local number here in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255 is the toll-free number here to reach the Dave Graham Show, and also to reach Travin's show this afternoon. It starts at about 1 o'clock, and you can check in with him. It sounds like he's got an interesting guest lined up to talk about the same topic of what's going on in Syria. I think we're going to be focusing for a few minutes on the developments related to the impeachment, all the hearings and so on in Washington. I believe we have Leonard Steinhorn on the phone with us this morning. Good morning.
Hey, happy to be here.
Leonard of CBS News, really appreciate you connecting with us. And I understand you've been following the blow-by-blow on the impeachment hearings and et cetera going on in the U.S. Capitol. Fill us in on what the headlines are today on that front.
Well, it's sort of a blow-by-blow and a lot of rings, so you have to keep your eye on a lot of things.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, yesterday, a top aide to the President Trump, who is no longer in the administration, testified behind closed doors and basically said that Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, is running almost a personal foreign policy on behalf of the president, and that's how this Ukraine issue came about. Basically, Giuliani traveling around the world trying to advance the president's political interests, and that's how we are ensnared in this whole Ukraine mess that we're in. Second, John Bolton, the recently departed national security advisor, who did not depart on good terms with the president, mm-hmm. apparently said that Rudy Giuliani is sort of a walking hand grenade, that he's trying to sell the president and the administration on something that could be very, very dangerous and potentially illegal. He's now writing a book, but a lot of people think that he may be the next person to testify in public because he may have a lot to dish. So there's a drip, drip, drip of information coming out. There's the ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, who was never a Trump supporter in the first place. He supported Jeb Bush, but he gave money to Trump, wanted to become an ambassador, and he's apparently sort of interlocked in this whole Ukraine situation. So there are a lot of things going on, and Congress is uncovering layer by layer by layer what happened in Ukraine, trying to see how close it gets to the president, what his involvement is, how he was coordinating with Rudy Giuliani effectively to use foreign policy for his personal political gain. So that's sort of where it stands now in a snapshot.
Yeah, and I was wondering, let's shift the focus just briefly, and I know you haven't this isn't your daily story right now, but the Syria situation, if you go back to the conversation that the president had with President Erdogan of Turkey just, 10 days ago now or so, I almost have to wonder, was he as, clumsy in that phone call as he might have been on the July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president?
Well, with the Ukrainian president, it appears that he sort of had some leverage, which was better relations or military aid that he would unfreeze if the Ukrainians went ahead and investigated Joe Biden. And again, remember, there's no evidence that Joe Biden and his son did anything wrong, even if one could argue that his son was involved in a form of influence peddling, you know, playing on his father's position as vice president.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, with Turkey, many people think that the president has simply gotten played by Erdogan in Turkey, that this is what Erdogan has wanted for a long time. The minute President Trump gave him the thumbs up on that, he went full steam ahead into Syria. Basically, he has sort of like Captain Ahab and Moby Dick, you know, and his great white whale is sort of destroying the Kurds who have been fighting on our side in Syria. And that may be what's happening right now. And of course, there are secondary effects, because Vladimir Putin is sitting there and smiling like a Cheshire cat, saying, hey, now his position in the Middle East has been strengthened.
Yep.
He's the power broker in Syria right now. So all of a sudden, people that we don't really necessarily like, Vladimir Putin, President Assad of Syria, ISIS, seem to be benefiting from this arrangement, and Erdogan is getting what he wants as well. So who eventually loses on all of this? Arguably, the United States of America and the Democratic allies who have been fighting on our side.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible. I mean, and of course, this comes the same week, basically, as the president is describing himself as, what was it, as somebody with great and unmatched wisdom. And I had the thought this morning, I was looking at this and kind of saying to myself, I don't know about great and unmatched wisdom, but some wisdom would be good.
there's a guy who once was helping to work on my home, had a little comment that I'll never forget. And he said, there's nothing worse than an incompetent perfectionist. And I think in this particular case, you have somebody who really believes he's very good at the deal. Or even if he isn't, he wants to put up that public image so that voters will support him and think that he's a great deal maker. Remember, that was one of his calling cards in 2016,
yeah,
that he can cut deals and get things done. Well, it seems like everybody else is cutting a deal with him at our expense and to their benefit. So the question is, why? Is it incompetence that's going on, and or incoherence that's going on? Does he have sort of a personal stake in seeing some of these governments, whether it's Turkey or Russia or the Syrians or even the Iranians, do better? I hope not, presumably not. Some people think that the countries that he seems to be most favorable towards are the ones that he's had business dealings with in the past. So some people say, well, do they have something on him? Do they know something about him? Will they reveal something on him if he doesn't do what they want? There are a lot of questions on this and not very many answers. The bottom line on all of it is that, you know, our national interest is at stake, and our reputation in the world as the most powerful country that's on the side of certain values. And I think this is where allies are looking at us and going, huh, what's going on? Can we trust the United States of America anymore?
Yeah, it's a strange and not very pretty picture here that we have found now, having been painted, and who knows how this is all going to turn out. One last question. Do you think that that these issues that are really coming home to roost in a bad way in the Middle East right now might influence anybody on the Hill related to impeachment?
Well, there's a lot of discontent among Republicans about what's happening in Syria with the Kurds and with Turkey, a lot of discontent. They're not necessarily saying it out loud. They're not necessarily criticizing the president too much because they're scared of the president going right after them, as he would do. They're worried about the president's base of voters, that 35% to 42% that are sort of with him regardless of what he'll do.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to alienate President Trump. They want to be on his side. They don't want to alienate his voters. They don't want to be attacked by him. But at the same time, they harbor a lot of doubts and uncertainties about what he's doing in foreign policy and how he's leading this nation, and also the tone of political discourse that he's orchestrating in this country. So there's a lot of concern. It's just not well spoken. The question is, does the impeachment inquiry reach a tipping point that enables some of these senators and members of the House to speak out more forcefully? Does it give them permission to say, yeah, maybe there is something wrong, and maybe we do have to do something, and maybe I have to really think about some of these charges that are taking place? I still doubt it, but again, you never know. The Republican Party was very united behind Richard Nixon throughout much of Watergate up until the end, and then the dam broke.
Leonard Steinhorn of CBS News, thanks so much for your insights and analysis this morning.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Hey, that is about it for the first hour of the Dave Graham Show on this Tuesday morning, the 15th of October. And appreciate it if you all stay around for the second hour of the program. We're going to be talking to a speaker brought in by AARP on the subject of accessory dwelling units. We'll be back, folks.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back, continuing into the second hour of our program for this Tuesday morning, October the 15th, 2019. Thanks very much for staying with us, folks. And got an interesting conversation, I think, coming up. We do talk a lot on this show, on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, about housing affordability in Vermont, and how there are a lot of folks think not enough new affordable housing being built in Vermont. It's an issue that comes up. We hear about it a lot from employers who say, we try to recruit people to come move to Vermont and work in our businesses and so on, and they come and they tell us they can't find a house to live in. And it's a deterrent, actually, to some folks moving into the state who might otherwise do so and join our communities up here. And certainly a state with a stagnant population wants to see people moving in sometimes. And so housing is one of those things that is a necessary component of welcoming people to move into the state. And one style of housing is starting to get some more attention in a couple different ways. One is just the general impact on the housing market. The other is, are there ways to ensure that as folks age, they are able to stay in place, stay in their own private homes, and don't have to be institutional. Of course, institutionalizing our seniors, very, very expensive. A lot of folks think not the best way to live for the people themselves, whoever ends up in the institution. And so there are issues there that make people want to think about ways to keep our older folks in their own homes longer. A solution to both ends of the housing situation might be, at least a partial solution, might be what are called accessory dwelling units. These are housing units that are built on already existing properties, if I understand how this works properly. And but I think what I should do is probably ask our guest, who is on the phone with us, Eli Spivak, has worked in developing a large number of accessory dwelling units in the Portland, Oregon area, from what I understand. He is a guest speaker being brought in this week to talk to folks here on behalf of AARP Vermont, and he joins us on the phone this morning to talk to us about accessory dwelling units. Good morning, Mr. Spivak.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad to do it. And how am I doing so far? Am I close on the definition of an accessory dwelling unit and why we need more of them?
I think you are. Yeah, an accessory dwelling unit is a terrible name for these things. but we have lots of historic names. It was really re-legalizing an old housing type that used to be called carriage houses or granny flats or apartment, garage apartments, things like that.
Yeah.
And it's a self-contained dwelling unit that's on the same property as a primary house. And they come internal to the house, like a carve out of the house or a detached structure or a converted garage. There's all different ways of creating them. But the basic idea is that it's just a small home, discreetly, you know, tucked into a lot in a single family neighborhood.
Yeah, that is interesting. You know, I know that city planners these days are talking a lot about increasing density, particularly in areas that are walkable to public transportation or walkable to village and town centers, and you know, enabling people to live close to work seems to be the underlying goal there. And so, I mean, I know that your discussion with the AARP was, from what I read on their materials I got, seemed to indicate a focus on housing for older folks. But it sounds like this could be really addressing a wide range of areas in the housing market. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. AARP has a particular interest in this because a lot of their members want to age in place in their own neighborhood, and many of them can't afford or don't want to take care of the big house they maybe raise their family in.
Yep.
But they also don't want to leave the neighborhood, so providing an ADU on the lot might be a way to oftentimes is a way they can move into a smaller house and still be near all the things that they know and maybe have support in the house to help take care of them as they get older, or they might take care of grandkids if it's a multi-generational household. But yeah, young people, millennials, are having a hard time moving out of they're boomeranging back to their family house more often than ever now, and they need a place to get a foothold into the housing market, get off on their own. So ADUs serve that purpose too. They're flexible over time. They might change their use again and again over decades.
Yeah, that is interesting. That phenomenon of young people, you know, the classic, you know, 28-year-old living in the parents' basement or something is another phenomenon we're seeing a lot in the housing market right now. And I have one friend recently refer to it as full nest syndrome. You know, we used to hear about empty nest syndrome when the kids grow up and move out, but now it's been turned on its head in some places anyway. So that's kind of funny.
Yeah. I do some co-housing projects in Portland, and sometimes I joke that the empty nesters are downsizing into a smaller home so that there's no room for their kid to boomerang back in with them.
Well, then there's always that strategy as well. Sorry, you can't move back home. We sold the big place, and now we don't have room for you. So you're of necessity out on your own, kid. So that's another way families sometimes work these things out, or obviously a wide range of approaches. But so you have been, is this your specialty, or you're a contractor who builds accessory housing units in the Portland area?
Yeah, I should clarify. So I am a developer and a general contractor. I did affordable housing development for about a decade, starting off with Habitat for Humanity and going on to multifamily stuff in the Portland area. Mm-hmm. I helped start a land trust, community land trust in Portland, which is, you got a lot of leadership from Burlington on that movement.
Uh-huh.
And I have built several ADUs. I built some detached bedrooms, some tiny homes. I have worked on policy changes in Portland and some waiving some fees for accessory dwellings that have helped us go from 20 a year about, starting in 1996, when we got rid of, we've allowed ADUs in Portland since the 80s, but in 97, we dropped the owner occupancy requirement. You can do them by right on any lot, no off-street parking required, all the sort of things that the cities are discussing today. And we had about 20 a year, not that many, for over a decade. And then in 2010, we changed a couple other rules and we waived some fees for them. And then the numbers started to climb and we did outreach. And we got to over one ADU per day permitted in Portland, up to about 500 one year. It settled down a little bit now that people know that they're not going away as an option. But it was a really strong, so I guess I say I'm an advocate for them. And I've worked with other cities and now entire states. I know Vermont already requires cities to allow ADUs. The same can be said for every city in Oregon and in California and in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
And I think New Hampshire also requires them. So both at the municipal level and at the state level, there's really a movement to make this housing option available because there's a recognition that single-family zoning, although perhaps well-intentioned, has become exclusive in many high-cost areas. And if you're a smaller household or a lower-income household, all that's getting built are large single-family homes, then you might have no place you could live in a whole neighborhood. And that's just not equitable.
Eli Spivak is my guest. Tell me about the event. You're speaking to AARP in when and where?
It is going to be this evening in Burlington at 5 o'clock, mm-hmm. and I honestly don't remember the location. I should. We'll get that out to you.
Yeah, I should as well. I'll look it up on one of the breaks. I think I have it someplace here. Or anybody listening from AARP wants to join in the conversation, 244-1777. Toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. We do welcome calls from listeners. And we actually do have another caller on the line right now. I was speaking with him last night. Ward Joyce is an architect and a design build person in Montpelier. And I was just interested in, you know, I said, we're going to hear from this gentleman from Portland, Oregon about accessory dwelling units. And I bet you Ward Joyce would be somebody who would know about how this development in the housing market is playing out on the ground here in central Vermont. So Ward Joyce, thank you very much for joining us this morning as well.
Hey, thank you, Dave.
And Ward, talk to us a little bit about how prevalent or not prevalent so far in Vermont, in your area of Montpelier in central Vermont, are these accessory dwelling units. Is this something you're seeing a boom or anything?
Well, it's definitely starting to happen. Montpelier has seen almost zero growth in the last 100 years, and mm-hmm. that's just because of a lack of land and a lack of housing opportunities. So there's a downsizing group in Montpelier with, I think, 50 to 75 people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s that are looking to get out of their big Victorians or their bigger old houses and find a smaller walkable unit downtown. And they just, for a couple of years, they just haven't been able to get traction on property. So the idea of small units in backyards is particularly appealing. It doesn't necessarily solve the problem for all 50 of them, but I did one last year in Montpelier, which was a small garage that got renovated. Mm-hmm. And for about $150 a square foot, we built a really beautiful little unit for, essentially a granny flat in the backyard of a nice lot. So I did a little research this morning with Montpelier's to make sure I knew what the laws were. But what's interesting is, as your last speaker said, there's a statewide and a national agenda. And the state basically has a rule that says that no community can keep a landowner from building an accessory dwelling if the lot is big enough and they can meet requirements like the parking needs and they can get water and sewer. Any lot in the state of Vermont should be able to build an accessory dwelling. So it has to meet the guidelines that are standard for the lot. And in Montpelier, anyway, the unit needs to be an efficiency or a one-bedroom, and it can only be 900 square feet in size, but as long as it fits those criterion, you can drop an accessory dwelling on any lot in the city of Montpelier.
Let me ask Eli Spivak, when you hear that those limits, for instance, that can't be larger than 900 square feet, does that bother you, or do you think that's easily something you could work within?
I think that's totally appropriate. I think that there's opportunity at the local level to be more flexible than the state gives, but it's great that Vermont requires cities to allow them. Some of the history on ADU regulations going back to 2000 is that a lot of jurisdictions have limits on which properties can create ADUs by minimum lot size or requiring off-street parking requirements or owner occupancy mm-hmm. or discretionary reviews or design compatibility. And these are intended to make sure ADUs don't overwhelm a neighborhood. In practice, when you have all those, it becomes death by 100 paper cuts. Sometimes with those well-intended regulations, not a single one gets built, because one thing, as I think Ward might have run into, is the ADUs are oftentimes built by amateurs, unlike any other kind of housing type. Single-family homes and, you know, four-story buildings are all built by the pros. People building ADUs, it's hard, even with strong regulations, yeah. even with supportive regulations. You got to have a lot of money in your back pocket or a home equity line of credit. You got to navigate the permit process, the zoning, building, utility connections, all that stuff. And so people who build them, it's oftentimes a labor of love. And they're trying to create a household situation that works for them. And sometimes it's important to make sure the codes are easy to work with, or you might not see any get built.
Yeah,
in Montpelier, the new zoning rules that we just passed state that regardless of density or district, the ADUs are acceptable in every part of the city. So we've kind of planned ahead for that. And in Montpelier anyway, I don't think we have. I mean, of course, you've got people adding a unit within their attic or something that might be done sort of by handy Andy and on their spare time, but I think we're finding that most of the ADU work here is actually quite exquisite and really nicely designed. But it's just as complicated as any piece of development. And I definitely recommend working with a designer and a good builder to make that really work well and to flow and to be affordable for sure.
Ward, let me ask you about parking, because I mean I'm sort of picturing a lot of Montpelier's neighborhoods are really tight, you know, just in terms of the space around the existing houses, and it seems to me that you want off street parking because, you know, there's the snow winter parking ban. You're not supposed to be on the street, for instance. Either that, or you'd have to start thinking about, you know, are there locations where Montpelier could have some off-site parking? You know, every little neighborhood have its, I don't know, its own little parking lot or something. So how do you factor that into these considerations?
Well, as you know, you have to have off-street parking by law in Montpelier because you can't park on the street in the winter.
Right.
So we just, the city just changed their parking requirements from 2 units per dwelling to 1. And that's, again, to help this kind of work. But I think if we think a little bit in advance and we think about electric vehicles and we think about automated vehicles and we think about electric bikes, I mean, I think the key to this policy and to this progression is to imagine less automobiles. And if the ADU proposals or if the ADU work is more downtown than rural, then we're trying to create a less of an automotive society. And I think if the two work together, that we get more density downtown and just 1 car per dwelling unit, then we're making our downtowns better places with both.
Yeah, it is a challenge sometimes, especially if you have multiple adults living in the same house and all driving age and different jobs in different places and so on,
and no public transportation
and not much public transportation, and you know, you could quickly end up running out of driveway space for the vehicles you need to accommodate, and I don't know whether anybody's actually are there any design answers there? I mean, are people starting to look at, I don't know, what, 2-story garages or something, or with a ramp? Or
In some parts in Houston, Texas, for example, there's a long tradition of having coach houses or garage apartments where there's a garage below and an accessory dwelling unit on top of it.
I see, yeah.
Oh. The Fonz lived right over Mr. Cunningham's garage. That was a ADU, basically.
That's right.
I thought I'd share is 900 square feet can easily fit over top of a garage.
Okay,
sure.
Older garages are
no step entries for older folks who need a no step entry. Convert a garage to a living space is another option.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a thought too. By a no step entry, you mean basically that ease of getting in and out of the dwelling unit without having to climb stairs or anything.
Yep.
Right. These are obviously design features as well that when you start thinking about housing geared toward people who are getting elderly, individual design components, everything from what kind of shower you're going to install to the doorways getting in and out are going to change somewhat. And Ward, let me ask you, actually, one of the motivations for accessory dwelling units or adding an apartment to your house historically has been the homeowner wants to get a little bit of rental income. It's just considered to be an investment sometimes. Given current construction costs and so on and so forth, is that still a workable thing? Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be. I think yesterday you mentioned the sense that putting a second unit on a property might decrease its value or decrease its marketability. But I think in today's economy, being able to buy a house with maybe a little extra cost because it's got a unit in back, but that provides rental income, can be, you know, it's like buying a duplex.
Yeah.
And essentially, if you can find a compatible person for in back or a senior that lives there, I think you can create kind of a synergy, both economically and socially, that can be a real benefit. And then the other interesting thing as a from a homeowner or an architect is that the little house can be a great little design project. So you can kind of go a little further with the details and the finishes because everything is so small.
Yeah.
A micro kitchen, a micro bathroom, micro bedroom. And so the character of the unit can actually be kind of fun. And so you can essentially put a contemporary piece behind an older house. And then it even provides the ability, as you get older, to move back into the smaller unit and allow the front unit to be a larger rental income for you. So I've got a bunch of people that are thinking that way about building something in the backyard in the short term for others and then transitioning back to it for themselves as they get older.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I mean, people obviously have different housing needs at different stages of their lives, and
exactly.
If you're a 40-year-old parent with four kids, that's a different picture than if you're a 75-year-old person living by yourself, for sure. So, hey, let's go to a caller on the line. We got Pat from Randolph. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. I had a question for Ward. Just wondering, he's familiar with Berry Square project in Randolph, Vermont. And I was wondering how he feels this might fit into this whole movement.
Ward, are you not with us? So, okay. I guess I'm hoping Ward will call us back shortly and maybe answer that question for you. Pat, what is the project in Randolph?
It's called Salisbury Square.
Okay, and describe that to us. I'm not familiar with it.
It's a project with smaller lots and has both single family and rental housing in it.
So are there some multi-unit buildings, or is it all single family buildings?
There are some multi-family, but also some single family, because that seems to be difficult to get new, smaller, single-family units that people can afford.
I see, okay. And it sounds, I mean,
can
it sounds like...
Can I comment on that one? Or?
Sure, yep.
So, accessory dwellings are just one form of discrete infill housing, and another is cottage clusters. And I don't know if Salisbury Square is an example of that, but some cities are allowing on a property we otherwise could build six full-size single-family homes that might typically be 2,500 square feet. Instead, they let you build almost twice that number of much smaller homes, maybe 1,200 square foot, oftentimes around a shared courtyard. And by doing so, create smaller housing options where all the homes are maybe 1,000, 1,200 square feet, maybe bigger than ADUs, but smaller than a normal house. And that makes sense with households nowadays. Two-thirds of them are one or two people right now. So
hey, I don't mean to interrupt, but we need to take a break for some bottom-of-the-hour news from CBS. A couple words from our sponsors. We'll continue this conversation on the other side. Thank you for the call, Pat.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back continuing our conversation about accessory dwelling units, which are small, generally apartments or small houses attached to existing properties that allow for a little bit of increasing density in some of our villages and towns, cities around Vermont and elsewhere in the country, really, and also allow for folks to have a different and maybe smaller housing option, particularly as they age. And AARP is hosting a speaker, a nationally recognized expert on this work, who's done a lot of advocacy for accessory dwelling units in the Portland, Oregon area. Eli Spivak is the man, and he's on the phone with us this morning talking about this topic, which I find pretty fascinating. I think a lot of Vermonters imagine perhaps doing this at some point. Also in the air, on the phone with us, I should say, is and on the air, is Ward Joyce, a design build architect from Montpelier. And Ward, I'm curious to know kind of how this plays out on the ground in Vermont. In your experience, would you say that when someone is interested in adding an accessory dwelling unit to an existing piece of property, does that tend to end up being, an apartment carved out of the existing structure, the already standing building, maybe split into a duplex of some kind, or maybe an addition to the existing structure, a standalone, you know, tiny house or other small structure out in the yard? Or is there any overall trend in terms of what type of accessory dwelling unit we're seeing?
Well, I think it's an evolving group. Mm-hmm. I think probably the addition to a house is less likely than carving something out or doing something that's a standalone. But the city of Montpelier right now has got a pilot program with the state where they are rolling out a grant system that they hope will become a broader program across the state, where the state housing board, instead of contributing $20,000 or $30,000 to each lower-income unit that gets built in large developments, instead providing some of that money directly to a homeowner that's going to provide that unit for the state, because it's very, very costly to renovate old, uninhabited buildings to put market rate and lower-income housing in them, and the state ends up spending quite a lot of money on each unit. So they're rolling out a program that they're working with Montpelier on right now, where they're giving small grants to folks that come in and say, you know, we need $30,000 to convert the attic to a unit, and then the grant program provides some impetus to make the project happen. And the reason they're doing it as a pilot is because they believe that this project will stimulate small housing units quicker than the bigger program that does larger buildings. So kind of the incremental small units dotted around in private property may stimulate the creation of small units. And so, I mean, in Montpelier, for instance, our planning department is so helpful. Whenever I go in, the building inspector, the planning assistants, and the planning directors are always there to answer questions. So I think the priority is to make more of these happen, and I think you'll find that cities are going to work with people in a really helpful fashion to try to really push this forward. So I think this is a climate in which these are well accepted by the market and well supported by planning departments.
And Eli Spivak, I gather you're a visitor to Vermont right now. I don't know how long you've been in the state, but do you have a sense of how Vermont stacks up in terms of its welcoming or maybe less welcoming nature to these kinds of accessory dwelling units versus what goes on in other states around the country?
I would put, first of all, I did look it up. I'll be speaking at the Burlington City Arts on Church Street from 5 to 6 p.m. So anyone who wants to do a deep dive on this, please join us. Burlington is, in the state of Vermont, are ahead of the curve in allowing ADUs. I think there's five states across the country where every city has to allow them, and you are one of those. Mm-hmm. At the local level, I think that there's still some of these sort of poison pill elements in the code, and I think that Burlington is looking at doing some changes that might help address that, because it takes more than it takes a code that doesn't have a lot of obstacles in it, because as Ward says, it's quite an endeavor to create an ADU even when the codes are supportive. So I think that you guys are in good shape. There's some parts of the country where ADUs are, in Chicago, for example, coach houses is their legacy word for ADUs, and there's still rules on the books saying that if you don't continually occupy one, you cease to be allowed to occupy it. So they're sort of getting rid of them, which is what some of the, like Washington, D.C., where I grew up, all the alleys were lined with basically accessory dwelling units where the help lived, and D.C. systematically got rid of them all, and now they're wishing they had them back, and they're trying to bring them back. So I think that in terms of supporting ADUs, Burlington and Vermont are doing a fine job, and I think that getting more people to know about them as an option is going to be helpful. Providing tours sometimes, that makes a huge difference. AERP members have been surveyed, and one-third of them would like to build an ADU. I mean, that's a huge huge numbers. You know, span that across the country. And part of it is seeing one, learning about them, knowing that it's an option on your property. And that's when the wheels start spinning. People start creating them.
Yeah, that's really interesting. In the era of saying let's try to discourage ADUs, which it sounds like some cities and towns actually were going through that. What were some of the motivations there? Were people finding they just didn't like it, that it did add to cars parked along the street or something, or what was the perceived downside?
I think there were a couple reasons. One of them was to free up the backyard to have a car park in it, because many cities built these ADUs before cars were prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And if you basically get rid of the ADU and replace it with a parking spot, then you've got parking for the main house. And the other reason is not so nice. It's trying to create exclusive neighborhoods where lower-income people cannot afford to live.
Yeah.
And so that exclusive instinct goes deep in our zoning codes, and it certainly played out with ADUs. There's a history there also, going back to even before that. Like, Thomas Jefferson built an ADU and lived in it while, you know, on the property on which they were building Monticello, and they moved into the big house.
Mm-hmm.
So there still is a history of building the small house, live in that first, and then build the big one.
That's interesting. Wow. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Paul in Worcester. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just want to ask quickly, though, I think it's a great concept, and obviously, you know, what's new is actually old there. You know, it's nice to see the revitalization or the attempts of making housing available. I'm wondering, though, if there's public funds coming in as any kind of incentive for the program, as an inducement for, you know, people to build these. Is there anything being done to ensure some affordability, you know, concept, you know, for people that, you know, right now, I don't know what a one-bedroom rent is in Montpelier, but from what I've heard, I can't quote anything, but from what I've heard, it's rather steep. It's pretty costly. So, you know, you have a variety of projects that Downstreet Housing and Community Development, the organization down in Barrie, has brought online recently, like the Taylor Street units. Some of those are affordable, I understand, and the French Block development there along Main Street, that's affordable. And they utilized a lot of public funds coming into that, tax credits and such. But I'm wondering if locally Montpelier is doing something to provide incentives for people to develop these. Is there, and maybe Joyce can, Ward can rather, address this. Is there something being done to ensure some segment are ongoing?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. You know, one of the factors is that the units inherently are smaller, and so that they hopefully have a lower rent, but actually built into the pilot program that Montpelier is doing with the state, there is a guarantee with the funding that, first of all, if your income is lower than a certain point, that helps you qualify for the grant, or you have to provide the housing to at below market rate for a certain number of years to even qualify for the grant. So they're building in, with the incentives of that grant and the support, they're building in support for that being at the lower end of the market.
Yeah, that. So there is a, you had mentioned previously, Ward, some grant money just being made available. I guess it's a fairly new thing. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a brand new thing. It's a pilot, but I was told that several of them have come online in the last month or two.
Hmm.
And the person to talk with at the city of Montpelier is Kevin Casey. He's in charge of that program, and I know that it's probably beginning to get full on the first rollout, but if it continues, then maybe they'll provide larger support. In the first round, anyway, they were looking for the projects that the least amount of money could facilitate, could take furthest. So they were looking for, you know, what you might call shovel-ready projects, where for $20,000, attic could be renovated instead of throwing in $20,000 for a $150,000 project in a backyard that probably is going to happen irrespective of a grant. So they were looking for kind of the most effective use of the money, targeting it toward smaller projects in phase one, but hoping that it would grow into a more robust program for all types of dwelling units or accessory dwelling units in its second and third phases.
All righty. Paul, does that answer your question?
Well, yeah, and just one follow-up, though. Yes, it does. What about the result from the increased in value? Are the assessors going to be taking into account the fact that, other than doing this for the right thing, you know, if a property owner wants to build these, then they're going to be, you know, taxes are already high. So obviously, if they're getting income from it, that's understandable. There's more value, but is there some way that, you know, that there's an inducement on that side that they're not going to be hammered by taxes from the resulting increase in their property value?
What do we know about that, Ward? Is there any sense that the tax increase will be?
It'll be commensurate.
Yeah.
So that's a great question. You know, that's something to encourage a municipality to. That's yet another bonus would be to say, for instance, that your tax rate could be fixed if you bring a unit online. But I don't know whether Montpelier's program entertains that mechanism. But
you know,
that's a good one.
Can I jump into national perspective on
that? Sure, yes, absolutely. Eli Spivak.
A bunch of cities around the country are experimenting with pilots like this. West Denver is, L.A. Moss in Los Angeles, Silicon Valley, CDFI in the Bay Area is providing a second mortgage for accessory dwelling units with a subsidized interest rate, so long as it's rented out to someone who income qualifies. And the idea of property taxes is a great one. We've talked about that in my area where we might waive property taxes on the ADU while a low-income person is renting the place to give someone a sort of an incentive or provide low-interest financing that you don't pay interest while someone's low-income living there. But one thought to know about the market rate ADUs, since they are smaller, we did a study and 15 to 20% of just market-built ADUs are rented for nothing. And that means that whoever's living there is a loved one, a family member, someone who's had the house made available to them. And if they weren't in that free ADU, they'd be competing in the market for market rate housing. So in many ways, ADUs is used as safety nets by people for loved ones. And that's a private sector version of affordable housing that doesn't happen very often.
Well, and thank you. Just one other follow-up question, and I'll get out of your hair. But I'm wondering, too, it's a strong word, I don't know, too many regulations on it. But if somebody turns it and flips it into an Airbnb, I mean, I guess you can't foresee everything that's going to happen on some of these, but that seems to be something that's really affecting the dynamics of the rental market right now, or the short-term rentals and how communities are trying to deal with that between taxation or control or registration. So I'll hang up now and just listen to the answers. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Paul. Ward, let me ask you that. What about... are we defeating the purpose of creating more affordable housing and or creating housing for seniors that the AARP is talking about? Are we doing that if the individual project to add an accessory dwelling unit really is what the property owner has in mind is to create some Airbnb income?
That's a great question. And Eli, what do you think about that? What are you seeing in the larger metropolitan areas?
I actually noticed in your schedule for the Planning Commission of Burlington, they're going to look at both ADUs and also short-term rentals. And I'm a big fan of, if a city has an issue with short-term rentals breaking into the housing stock, then by all means, they should regulate them. And that should cross all types of housing, because single-family homes, apartments, condos, ADUs all get used for short-term rentals. So having a blanket rule makes a lot of sense. One thing we did in Portland is we've been waiving for 8 years the impact fees or system development charges you pay to create an accessory dwelling unit. It's worth about $13,000 we've been waiving. So in that way, we've been subsidizing them to some extent. And we just decided recently that if you're going to continue to get that fee waiver, you have to sign a 10-year agreement not to use it as a short-term rental. And so that's sort of a political compromise, which I think made sense because we want to encourage the creation of accessory dwelling units and are willing to forego some city revenue a little bit to make that happen. But we don't want to subsidize the creation of short-term rentals. If someone wants to do a short-term rental, then they can, but they got to pay the full fees in that situation. I think that it's appropriate for cities to think this one through, but to remember that all sorts of housing gets used as short-term rentals. It's not just ADUs. And so it's good to have sort of a broad brush approach for that.
And he's giving a talk later on today, this evening in Burlington. You said City Arts, Eli?
Yes.
correct.
And it's going to be from 5 to 6 p.m. And folks who are maybe interested in looking into, do I have an accessory dwelling unit in the future of my own property? Could I add an apartment onto my house, or could I put a tiny house or some kind of a extra unit in the backyard? Anybody with questions like that might want to attend this event this evening, this talk sponsored by AARP Vermont. And I think it is a fascinating topic. Also on the line with us is Ward Joyce. He's a design build architect in Montpelier. And someone who is actually starting to get into the accessory dwelling unit movement, if it's a movement yet. Maybe it's too fledgling to be labeled a movement yet. I don't know. But Ward, let me put this question to you. You have folks who come to you in Montpelier and ask you about a whole range of different projects. If someone comes to you and says, I'm thinking about an accessory dwelling unit on my property, I know this could be pretty individualistic depending on the specific property, but as a general rule, are there things you would urge them to think about right off?
Well, the first thing I always talk about with clients is probable cost, mm-hmm. because construction costs have gone up so much in the last 10 years. Sometimes it's startling for people to realize that building a new house can be $400,000 kind of before you even realize it. So the advantage of a small dwelling unit either in or outside of a building is that it's going to have quite a bit lower cost,
yep.
Than larger new construction. But, I have to immediately say, if it's a new building, let's just start by looking at what $200 a foot is going to imply. So 1,000 square feet times 200, even building a garage in your backyard that had a full living unit above it, could be $150,000 to $200,000. So you have to do the reality check first on cost.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I need to start. But, the first thing you do is you look at the lot and then you run it against the criterion for what is required to pull it off in terms of site size and, mm-hmm. How do you get water and sewer to it? That has been a hurdle for a lot of people in Montpelier, realizing that hooking up to sewer and water for your back building could be $15,000.
Yeah, wow.
Kind of thing. And so that's a big first hurdle to jump, is realizing that you've got to bring those utilities and you've also got to bring electrical and a driveway. And
yep. Hey, Ward, I got to interrupt you for just a second, and I'm told that Eli actually needs to depart the scene here, and Eli, I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate you taking the time to fill us in on some of the issues connected with accessory dwelling units. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alrighty. We just have a few more minutes to go. Ward, are you okay to stick around for one or two more questions?
Sure.
Okay. Let's go to a caller. We have Brad from South Burlington's on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. The question is, a lot of the housing that's been developed in the last 20, 30, 40 years has been subdivisions, and sometimes there's covenants that were created by the original developer that says there's only one single family or home per lot. There hasn't been any recent legislation or anything that would override those restrictions to allow a homeowner to put in an accessory unit, or is that what's the status of that?
Ward, do you have a sense of that?
Well, yeah, those covenants can be kind of binding, and I mean, I know a property here in Montpelier that has a preservation covenant that said that the only people that can live on a farm were people basically working on the farm, and so there was an idea of creating kind of a co-housing project on the farm, and it got pretty quickly and thoroughly shut down by the land trust, because that wasn't the way they defined the future use of this farm that they bought the development rights for. So it's a challenge. I mean, there's some communities like in our area around Montpelier that have no zoning, and there's others that have strict zoning. And I know people that have actually moved and created multi-unit projects in the communities where they could do it, where they couldn't feasibly in others. So, this Vermont can be a little bit of the Wild West from community to community, and unfortunately,
some of these projects have had to be located in less stringent zoning centers, which is why I think the new awareness of this is hopefully going to bring more and more communities into this more advanced planning.
Well, that's an interesting question, Brad. I know other parts of the country. I have relatives who live down in the Carolinas, and boy, they are very, very restricted on what they can do in their own neighborhoods, almost to the point of I sometimes kind of scratch.
So I agree. There was a I remember Act 250 used to have allow for no clotheslines outside drying the clothes.
Uh-huh.
That I think that's gone away now, and that's allowed even in the old permits. It's not enforceable any longer, I believe.
Yeah,
it's kind of the same case where we're evolving a little bit in some of these older subdivision rules. And
sure, yeah. Probably. Well, it makes sense. I mean, there are some of them that were probably put in a time when people just weren't thinking clearly about some of the issues. I mean, no clotheslines means you got to use an inside dryer and all the energy use, et cetera. Hey, I got to call it quits on this thing here today. The Dave Graham Show at WDEV, that is. I want to thank my friend Ward Joyce for joining me this morning. Ward, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Dave. It was a great program.
Yeah, and that's going to about do it for today's show. Stay tuned now for Common Sense Radio. Our friend Travin later on today, about 1 o'clock, is going to have an interesting guest on talking more about experiences over in Syria. And in between, sandwiched in between those two, of course, is our midday news service. Have a great day, everybody. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.